Committees on Human Services and Public Safety of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means for Tuesday, January 23, 2007. It is an informational meeting, and I will turn the microphone over to Doug Wilson from Legislative Fiscal.
Members of the committees and subcommittees, this is a continuation of yesterday's. Yesterday's dealt with the dependency side of the family of Chris. And today we're going to walk through probably a little bit shorter presentation on the adult criminal side. So you'll see a different set of actors, but also see some of the same actors that you did yesterday. Judge Maurer from Multnomah County is back as the narrator and moderator, and Judge McSheen, I hope I pronounced it right, from Multnomah County is the judge in this case. So we'll turn it over to Judge Maurer.
Thank you so much, and welcome to everyone, to the chairs and committee members. I wanted to recap just briefly what we'll be doing today. As those of you who were here yesterday are aware, we tried to show you what happens to a family when it is involved in methamphetamine, an arrest of the parents has occurred, children have gone into care, and the courts and all of the other agencies begin to address that circumstance. Today we are focusing on what happens with the adults, that being the parents in this case, Chris and Sally. The situation that you are being exposed to is, I want to reiterate, one that is fairly simplistic, as was yesterday's. In other words, we're trying to show you issues that are common to many cases that come before the court, with an understanding that they are like human beings, complicated. And so I hope all of you will bear with us as we do that and ask questions when the time is appropriate. As I said, Chris and Sally, the parents, went into custody initially following the search warrant that was executed at their home. And the police report and the evidence are being processed by the crime lab and the police and the district attorney. And sometimes that takes some time before the district attorney's office knows whether it has sufficient evidence to move forward. In this particular case, we want to introduce you to the concept when the police officer is having a conversation with the deputy district attorney about how to proceed with the case. You will recall that the evidence against Chris, the father, at the scene was different from the evidence against Sally, the mother. So I'm going to introduce you to the officer and the prosecutor at this time. And this is not in the courtroom. This would be over in their office. So I'll let you just be talking in your office.
Hi. As you know, we found a substantial amount of meth in the house, along with three credit cards with different names on each one of them. We did get a taped confession from Chris. He told us that in that confession, he told us that Sally didn't have any knowledge of what he was doing. He's the only one that had access to that back room, the one with the key. And when we talked to Sally, she confirmed that.
Well, based on that information, I'm not prepared to charge Sally. I don't think there's enough evidence to sustain any charges against her, at least at this point. If you get more of this, we can reconsider that. However, there is sufficient evidence, a lot of evidence, actually, to charge Chris. So I would be prepared to charge him with a possession of a controlled substance. Did you say it was a substantial quantity?
Yeah, it was a pretty fair amount. I don't know the exact weight right now, but it was pretty significant.
Okay. And also with the identity theft and the theft one charges regarding the credit cards from the other victim.
Okay.
Oh, and also a child neglect, I think, would be appropriate in this case.
Okay. Just so you know, we have contacted the victims and the ID thefts from the credit cards that we found. They are not able to be here today, but you know, they basically told us that they want this guy help. And the reason is they've suffered some pretty significant financial losses because of this.
Okay, well, we'll see what we can do to potentially get them some restitution.
All right, thank you. So that would be the conversation that happens between the police officer and the deputy district attorney about whether or not there is sufficient evidence to charge the individual who was the subject of the arrest. And now we're going to move into the arraignment, the prosecutor having made the decision to charge the father and not at this time to charge the mother pending further investigation. And so in this particular case, the charge person, this would be Chris, the dad. He is here with his attorney. The judge is going to conduct the arraignment. And I told you the arraignment has to occur within 36 hours of custody. And so it happens fairly quickly.
All right, we are here in the case of the State of Oregon versus Chris Lewis. This is the time and place set for his arraignment. If I could start by asking the district attorney if the victims were notified of the arraignment.
Good morning, Your Honor. Christine Landers on behalf of the state. Yes, the victims were notified of this arraignment this afternoon, and I have some release information for you at the appropriate time.
All right. And defense counsel, your name, please.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Greg Hazard-Abedian from the Public Defender's Office for Chris, the defendant here. My client would like to enter a not guilty plea at this time. I'd like to request a jury trial and would like to invoke his rights to remain silent. In addition, we would ask the court to consider release after the interview by the pretrial release officer. Mr. Lewis indicates that he has some work and that he is a sole support for his family. We want the court to know that if he stays in custody, he's likely to lose that work, and that would leave his family without financial means. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, counsel, thank you. The state's position on release?
Your Honor, we are opposed to a recognizance release. There was a substantial quantity of methamphetamine found in the house, and the defendant's children are still in care based on the conditions of the home. In addition, the victims that were contacted by law enforcement have indicated that they do not want the defendant to be released. They are suffering sort of an ongoing identity theft problem and have sustained some pretty significant restitution issues or pretty significant financial losses as a result of defendant's conduct.
Given the amount of drugs that were seized and the lack of detailed information about work in the living situation of Mr. Lewis, I'm going to authorize a pretrial release interview by a pretrial release officer. No further release until ordered by the court. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, now over the course of the next 35 days or so, the district attorney will be meeting. The defense attorney will be meeting with his client, Chris. The defense attorney has significant issues to explore with his client. He needs to go over the information that has been provided by the district attorney's office, determine if there are any defenses, determine whether or not it's appropriate to file pretrial motions. He is also going to want to explore any mental health issues. As you may be aware, a significant number of people who come before the courts suffer from mental health issues, and that is sometimes most obvious at the very time the defense attorney is speaking with the client. In this particular case, he fears that there may be some organic brain damage as a result of the methamphetamine, and there may be a mental health disorder that needs to be explored. In this particular case, therefore, explores those issues ultimately through contact with a psychologist, concludes that the client is able to aid and assist in his own defense, and so the case can move forward. And during this time, the prosecutor, for her part, has been talking about the case with the victims. Understandably, they have suffered a significant loss, and the victims are upset and angry about that. But some of them don't want to testify, and some of them do want to testify. And that can be an issue that is posed for the prosecutors. So in this particular case, I'm going to let you watch a discussion that can occur between a defense attorney and a prosecutor as they attempt to achieve some resolution, each knowing that there are weaknesses in their side and strengths in their side. So you go forward.
What are the chances you think we can settle this case?
Well, that depends on the client, really. You want to talk about our resolution?
Yeah, I'd like to.
Okay. Well, the drugs have been tested, and the crime lab determined that there is a substantial quantity of methamphetamine. So he can plead guilty to the PCS with a substantial quantity. One count of the identity theft, and I'll dismiss the others. One count of theft one, I'll dismiss the others. I think there's two additional counts of ID theft and two additional theft ones that I'll dismiss. But your client has to agree to pay restitution to all of the victims, not just the victims he's convicted on. I'll dismiss that child that left, your defendant. Mr. Rose will agree to do parenting classes. He's a 16 on the felony sentencing guidelines. That puts him in a presumptive prison for 1 to 15, 18 months. I'll recommend 15 months.
Let me just start off by saying I understand we have some liability here, and I understand you can prove some of these crimes. That's why I'm here on behalf of Chris talking about a resolution. But I have had my investigator look into things, and I know that at least two of your victims have criminal records and are not very interested in coming to court to testify. In addition, my client has a decent chance of getting the same sentence you're proposing after trial, if not better. You're not going to get those four felony charges anyway because the victim was after trial. Mr. Lewis has been crime free for 5 years and just got off track in the last few months. He definitely needs to do some treatment and is motivated to do so. He'd like to straighten out his life. Any chance we can avoid prison?
Well, I don't know. You know, I think I can probably get a victim's finger if I work on him. I'm usually able to do that. But you're correct. Your guy's been crime free for a number of years, so I guess I'm willing to give him a chance. Maybe against my better judgment, but I'll go ahead and make him a plea offer. He pleads to the charges that I suggested, that I do that to death one and that PCS substantial quantity. I'll agree to a downward departure, a stipulated downward departure, and he does 3 years of probation, 6 months in jail, and that's not negotiable. Drug and alcohol evaluation and treatment, parenting classes, and then restitution of all the victims.
I'm pretty sure that offer will be accepted. If you don't hear from me by 5 o'clock, I'll consider her case settled. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
All right, I want to slow that down a minute. I know probably all of you are pretty familiar with the sentencing guidelines, but you're going to be watching the plea take place in a few minutes. What was just happening there, as you know, was a negotiation that was taking place between the defense lawyer who has an obligation to represent Chris and the prosecutor who has an obligation to represent the state of Oregon. She obviously has ongoing concerns about her victims and their sense of being included in the process, but she also knows that a couple of them themselves have criminal convictions. And sometimes people with criminal convictions don't want to testify. And sometimes people without criminal convictions still don't want to testify. And I think it's a fair statement, and I'd ask you, Christine, to address that. The degree to which you have to consider some of those factors when you're trying to structure a plea negotiation.
Well, that is important. The victim's concerns are always very important to a DA when we're trying to settle a case, as well as, you know, victims with criminal histories are sometimes unreliable and difficult to locate depending on what kind of criminal history they have. They can also sometimes be impeached with their criminal history. And so all of those things are considered by me or other deputy DAs when we're deciding what we're going to do with the case. We also have very real resource allocation issues. Like all of the public agencies, there's not enough trial time to go around and try every case, so we just absolutely have to negotiate most of our cases. This is a case that would settle based on the evidence and based on the charges. This is a case that would settle in real life, more likely than not.
And can I ask you then also, although the sentencing guidelines, as you said, call for a presumptive sentence of 15 to 18 months in prison, that you factored a number of other factors into making your decision that it would be more appropriate and perhaps more productive in protecting the community to place him on an extended period of supervision with upfront jail time, parenting classes, and drug and alcohol treatment?
The reality is that Chris is going to get out at some point, and not very far in the future. Even if he goes to prison for 15 months, he's going to get out. He's still going to have those two kids. He's still going to have a methamphetamine addiction. That is not to say that people don't necessarily deserve to go to prison for doing what he did. Some of them do. But in this particular case, there are a lot of things that are considered, and you are probably all somewhat familiar with the sentencing guidelines and the mitigating factors that are outlined in the guidelines. This is a person who potentially fits directly into the optional probation analysis that a treatment program will hopefully end his criminal activity and make him a productive member of the community in order to benefit both the community and his children, who are also victims in this case, and the DA would not forget that. The children, no one is talking to me necessarily about those kids, but they're always in the back of my mind that those kids are out there and they need somebody to support them, and they need
a father who has been certainly held responsible for his conduct, but who is also going to get out at some point and needs to be given some resources to be productive.
Chair, may I ask you if you could ask, I don't know if some of the committee members might have questions as well.
Yes, thank you. Committee, any questions for any of the participants here in the process?
I want people to feel free to ask questions.
Hey, is it all right if we break in and
that would
do
be
the presentation?
Okay, then.
So, if he reoffends it 2 years down the road, then we go back to look at his past record. He only has the one count of this and the one count of that. His true record is not really. I mean, it shows the convictions, but I mean, all these other things he's been arrested for just kind of go away.
Great question. Take
it. I'll take a stab at that, Representative. I know in my experience that when clients do reoffend and come back into that situation, that the district attorney who's handling the case has the old file and will be well aware of what charges were dismissed and what the actual conduct of the last case was, rather than just what the charges of conviction were. And so, while I appreciate your question, in my experience, those things are not lost on the prosecutors.
I could actually add something to that, too. Because of the way the sentencing guidelines are structured, we're not actually, by giving away the charges that we've given away, we're not actually losing anything on the guidelines. So while he is only being convicted of one ID theft and one theft one, he's really going to be in the same position after conviction as if he'd been convicted of the three ID thefts and the three theft ones on the guidelines. He's still going to be a repeat property offender. All of those things are still true. And that's something that we do consider when we're deciding what we want the person to plead to is, you know, where are we going to put him on the guidelines if he does reoffend? He's also, if he reoffends in 2 years, he goes to prison. If he goes back to gridlock, he's still on probation. He goes back to gridlock, he does in 15 months on this case.
One comment. I know I look like a criminal. I'm not.
Sure.
That's what they all say. They all say I'm in a
situation.
But I am a defense lawyer, and sometimes I get these probation violation cases, and I'll tell you, the judge on the probation violation level is quite aware of what went before and the consequences that's factored into the consequences. You are right. In the future, there are certain convictions, things that he could have been convicted for, that do not appear on his record and are not counted on the guidelines. But the district attorney is absolutely correct. Maybe he's maxed out the points and he's there.
Yeah.
So negotiation is a simple thing that balances a lot of factors, and Chris is on the hook.
And we're going to see some of that as this little scenario unfolds, and then we'll come back if we can. Or does somebody else have another question? Right,
Senator Burdick has a question.
Okay,
I do have a question. By giving the downward departure to 6 months, you've basically confined him to the county jail as opposed to the prison. And I come from a county with a pretty serious bed shortage. So, as a prosecutor, are you concerned about the matrix at the county level, and where would someone like Chris fit on the matrix?
Well, no, I don't think anyone has a worse jail bed shortage than Clackamas County, which is where I'm from. So, yes, I am always concerned about that, especially when we're dealing with property offenders. They are not extremely high on the matrix. But we, you know, I have to balance everything. The other kind of reality of this process is that if I don't give him the downward departure, the judge can do it anyway. And I'm always trying to figure out what the right thing to do, not just what the maximum time that I can get is, which in this case would be more than 15 months. But yes. You ask me where he would be on the matrix. I am not the best person to answer that question. We have probably some jail sentences who might be able to do it. I would imagine that Chris would not be real high, but they're less likely to matrix a sentenced individual than they are to matrix someone like pretrial. The place where he would probably have been matrixed, frankly, is at the beginning of the case when the judge recommended the release interview. The likelihood, actually, at least in Clackamas County, is that in spite of what the judge said, he would have walked out that door sometime around 9 o'clock that night.
To follow up, Chris seems like a perfect candidate for drug court. How would someone like Chris find his way into drug court? Would he have to serve part of his sentence first, and then would that be a condition of probation?
Drug court is usually something, Senator, that is determined by the district attorney's office, which is the gatekeeper for drug court in whichever counties have it. And it's determined at the front end of the case. And so there was something about Chris's background or Chris's conduct or the charges against Chris that caused the district attorney, probably not the same DA handling the case, to determine that Chris was not a good candidate for drug court in this case. So we've already passed that process. Drug court doesn't tend to be used after. If it's not used initially, it's not used later.
Something got into level C, to the C column of the guideline, right? And more than Christmas card.
I think in our little scenario, he had an assault conviction, which might actually exclude him from drug court and collective felony. That tends to be people with very, very small criminal history, and most of the time not presumptive prison criminal histories go into drug court.
And I'm going to have Judge McShane speak to that for Multnomah County as well.
I know in Multnomah County, although Chris would look just like somebody in drug court, we have such a large drug court that we don't allow property offenders in, even though it's the drug addicts who are committing the property offenses. We just haven't had the funding to expand it to property offenses. On that issue of 6 months local versus sending them to the penitentiary, one of the struggles we have as judges is we know if the presumptive sentence is somewhere around 13 to 20 months, there aren't any real programs available in the penitentiary. The boot camp program, the Powder River Drug Treatment Program, that's be up almost a 22, 24-month level before they're eligible for those programs, where we at least have a shot, a narrow shot, on a local sentence of then transferring them into an inpatient program. So there's some transition then back from jail, a program to the community. Now that piece has slowly been disappearing. But with the conviction and a probation officer, there's a more likely chance that they'll get into an inpatient program.
And although we haven't touched on it too much in this little scenario, a defense attorney oftentimes would be talking as well about the impact on the children that we know went into care yesterday, or I mean, not yesterday in our scenario, but several weeks earlier at the time of the father's arrest. So there are myriad factors that come into play when families are affected with the realization that the children who grow up with parents who have been drug users and gone to prison for extended periods of time and back and forth are themselves more likely to grow up and experience those same problems. So the courts, I think it's fair to say, are aware of that. The prosecutors are aware of that. The defense bar is aware of that. And there's an effort to derail that train whenever it's possible. So I want to move forward now through the plea itself. This is where the judge will go ahead and make sure that Chris wants to go forward with the plea.
All right, we're back on the record on State of Oregon versus Chris Lewis. This is the time and place, I understand, for a hearing for a change of plea on the indictment. I'd like to have the attorneys present themselves, and if I could hear from the state whether any of the victims are present.
Morning, Your Honor. Christy Miners again on behalf of the state. This is time set for a change of plea, and defendant will be pleading guilty to one count of PCS substantial quantity, one count of identity theft, and one count of theft one. They're all victims present when we get to the point of sentencing, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Greg Hazard, obedient for Mr. Lewis. Pursuant to negotiations, Mr. Lewis is prepared to plead guilty, and the state will recommend 3 years probation. The terms of that probation will be recommended to the court as including 6 months in jail, drug, alcohol, and mental health assessment and treatment, and the usual fines, costs, and assessments. Plus, Mr. Lewis will be paying restitution to all the victims in these cases. We may need to have an additional hearing, in fact, about the exact amount of that restitution, Your Honor. Thank you.
And counsel, Mr. Lewis is a 6C on the guideline grid, which is a presumptive prison sentence. What's the basis for the court to depart to a probation sentence?
I don't know if you'd like, I can handle that.
Yes.
This is a stipulated downward departure. We are stipulating to the downward departure on two bases. One is that the defendant has been crime-free for a significant period of time, specifically 5 years. The other basis is the optional probation criteria that a treatment program in the community does exist that would hopefully cause defendant to not engage in any additional criminal activity, he can be promptly admitted into that treatment program, and it would be in the best interest of the community for that to occur. He is, and we are recommending that he do 6 months in jail. I'd also like to state for the record and for Mr. Lewis's benefit that he's getting a break here, and I don't expect to be back on any probation violation hearings. If we are, the state will be recommending revocation and the prison sentence.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
At this point, what would happen is the judge would take the plea petition, it's 3 pages in length, would review the plea petition with the defendant to make sure that the defendant has read it, understands it, whether the defendant has any questions that the defendant wants to ask of the court, and then to take the defendant's plea if the judge concludes that the defendant is entering into the plea freely and voluntarily and intelligently. And so at this point, the judge has gone ahead and had that process occur.
All right, I'm going to accept Mr. Lewis's guilty plea. With regard to sentencing, my understanding we are proceeding today. Does the state have victim statements they'd like to present?
I do, Your Honor. The victims are present. I would note that the state talked to all of the victims. Only two of them are present here today and want to make statements. They differ a little bit in their perspective, but I think that they both understand why the state did what the state has done. And now I'll turn it over to them.
Your Honor, I don't know how to express my feelings and frustrations toward this person, but I'm going to try. I have spent the last several months trying to have my credit report fixed and negotiating with companies that say I owe them money when I know that I don't. It's been extremely frustrating. I hope this court follows the recommendations and that the defendant gets the treatment he needs so that this doesn't happen again.
Thank you, sir.
Your Honor, I've also been struggling, and it's taken me months, and I am so frustrated. I'm trying to get my finances back in order. Chris has really wreaked havoc in my life. I think you should put him away for at least 10 years. If he's out in 2 years or less, he's just going to go back to doing the same thing over and over again, and I'm sick of it.
Thank you, ma'am. Counsel, does your client wish to make a statement?
Not at this time, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right. Then based on the comments, the recommendations, I will follow the recommendations that have been presented to the court. I'll find that it's a reasonable resolution, and the sentence recommended in the plea petition be imposed. Thank you.
All right. Let me ask a couple of questions here. Is that all right?
Yes, please.
Thank you. Judge McShane, you have two very different perspectives. One victim obviously wants a 10-year sentence, if that were possible, which it isn't, but understandably feels incredibly violated. The other victim feels violated but seems less inclined to want the 10-year sentence. How do you address that when you're in court and you have very divergent views, or perhaps only one view, and that view is 10 years?
It's a good time to educate people in the courtroom. A lot of people come in, victims can come in with pretty, not just unrealistic, but illegal ideas of what a judge can do. And we may all feel the way the victim does. But I try as much as I can to explain the reality of our sentencing guidelines, our sentencing structure. At least in my court, I'm very... It's very important to me that the victims know that probation is serious, especially if there's restitution issues. I give the victim my card, and the victim can call my staff if those payments are not being made. Often it's not realistic that the payments are ever going to get made, but I think it's important that they have somebody to talk to. Often the probation officer isn't particularly going to follow up and talk to the victims of the crime about what's happening on the probation, but we can. So I do let them know what will happen if there's, you know, a gross failure on probation down the road. That's often the best I can do, is educate them about what can happen if the defendant doesn't follow through and what we can realistically do.
And let me ask you, Ms. Landers, in terms of your addressing the victims, obviously it's important that victims who have rights, their constitutional rights, have an opportunity to be heard. How do you address the concerns of the victim vis-a-vis your obligation to represent the community at large?
So I talk to all of the victims. Sometimes victims don't want to talk to me, and if they don't want to talk to me, they don't have to. But I will frequently have an experience where a victim calls me and they say something like, you know, I want 20 years. And there's no way that we can give
person that was 20 years. It's illegal. It's not going to happen. It's just impossible. And then I go through with them and explain to them, and sometimes have to tell them sort of the hard facts of life. And sometimes the facts of life are pretty much suck for victims. That's not possible. I will get them restitution ordered. Whether or not it gets paid is an unknown at this point. The checks will trickle in slowly and in very small amounts. I'm always sympathetic to it, but you also have to be often firm with them and just say, you know, I understand what you're saying, but we can't do that here, and here's why.
Let me interrupt one second and flip it. Now you have a victim that doesn't want prosecution.
And that happens too. That happens very often in family abuse cases, child abuse cases in particular, where the father is the defender and the mother is not wanting the father prosecuted for oftentimes some really pretty horrific offenses. And again, you have to be very firm with them and explain to them that I don't represent the victim, I don't represent any specific person, I represent the community. I have to do what's best for the community. And what's best for the community in this case is prosecution, and that's what's going to happen. And that they have to cooperate with the prosecution. They have to provide themselves as a witness. If I personally serve them with a subpoena, they have to bring their child to court. All of those things. So it's a balancing act, oftentimes dealing with victims, because I am the ultimate decision maker in a case. The DA is constitutionally mandated to make the resolution decision. We can't hand that responsibility over to the victims. It wouldn't be appropriate. But sometimes they don't understand that, and they have to be educated about that process. I always assure them that their wishes and their input is considered, but it's frankly not always followed. And I have been in court before in front of judges where I've had to tell the judge the victim's family does not agree with the resolution, but I believe that it's in the best interest of the community and in the best interest of justice.
And from the defense perspective.
Thank you. So there are cases where the defense investigator or defense attorney will contact the victim or the victim's family in a case, and a lot of times once the victims understand how the process works, they are in support of a resolution of the case, because there's a lot of perceived trauma in a lot of the way society thinks about coming to court is perceived as a traumatic event, and it's not for those of us who play in the system every day, but it is for people who don't come to court every day. And once victims have it explained to them that a plea bargain is a way for them to get the judgment of restitution, for them to have the offender held accountable, and for them to maybe have the offender get the services that the offender needs to not recreate the crime again, a lot of times victims will be in support of those kinds of resolutions. Clearly not all the time, but sometimes the defense lawyer will reach out to the victim and have that conversation, and sometimes people realize they'd rather avoid the trial and agree to the settlement of the case. Now, a lot of times, prosecutors and defense lawyers are working together on that particular issue to try to help educate members of the community who aren't players in the system like we are.
Yes, good. Well,
if I could, as a defense lawyer, sometimes the consequences that victims want, and who can argue with their righteous outrage that they, they've been assaulted in, certainly, no matter what the crime. The emotional reaction, though, may make it difficult for them to get the satisfaction or the restitution that they need. If Chris doesn't pay the restitution, well, he doesn't get his driver's license back. Well, he doesn't have his driver's license because there's drugs involved, and that makes it very difficult for a person to work. There are all these unintended consequences of statutes that come to bear. A lot of times the ladder is just pulled up. Chris looks like one of these guys, a classic guy. He gets on, he's been out, and he's been on the wagon for a while. He gets into methamphetamine, a very awful drug that drives your own bus. He's not driving it. He's selling stuff. He's not making a lot of money selling methamphetamine, but just enough to support his habit. But it's a very vicious sort of thing. And if you do a draconian sort of sentence, the victims are never really going to be, their needs are not going to be addressed by the defendant. He's trying to stay above the law.
And I don't know, Chair McPherson, if any of the committee members have any questions about that?
Let's pause for a moment and see if they're any.
Okay. No? Okay, great. Well, then we'll just move on to the next scenario. Now, what has happened here is Chris has served his 6 months in jail, pretty much, and he's released. And so Chris is going to be now out in the community, and of course he has to report immediately to his probation officer because the judge did put him on probation. So the county probation officer, well actually it's the state probation officer, is going to now be talking to Chris.
Good morning, Chris. You're on probation for 3 years from the date of your sentence. You were placed on a downward departure probation, meaning that in the event of any violation, you could be sent to prison based on the original sentence. We'll be assessing your risk and needs and to establish a plan for your period of supervision. This will be a plan to help you succeed, and you'll be held accountable for the following plan. As conditions of your probation, you must report monthly, not drink or use drugs, enroll in alcohol, drug, and mental health treatment, commit no new crimes, pay fines, fees, and restitution. You must search for a job and show documentation of your efforts. You must also meet with the treatment person this week, and that appointment will be set for you.
All right, and so now Chris would leave the probation officer's office, and Chris has been told he has to report to a treatment provider. Chris is therefore going to do that. So we'll have Chris have a conversation now with the treatment person.
Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
Pleasure to meet you.
We want to, first of all, do an assessment and determine your level of care, and then we'll have some group sessions for you to start. Some individual sessions. We'll definitely take some urine tests from you. And we will be working really closely with your parole officer.
All right. Where do we start?
All right. So, now I'd like you to envision 8 months having passed. Chris, unfortunately, has discontinued some of his treatment. He's failed to stay in touch with his probation officer, and a warrant is issued. And let me tell you how that typically will happen. The judge will be notified. The judge then issues a warrant based on the affidavit of the probation officer. And the district attorney then notifies the victim of the hearing date. And when Chris is arrested on that warrant, he is brought before the court. And he is typically provided an attorney if he wants an attorney. And the victims can come. And the district attorney, and in this particular fact scenario, the probation officer as well, are recommending that the probation be revoked. And the judge, therefore, goes ahead, revokes the probation, and sentences Chris to 18 months in prison with 24 months of post-prison supervision. So now, I want to slow that down just a little bit. All of you heard that Chris got a break. Remember, he got the 6 months jail on a probationary sentence with kind of a promise by the DA that if he dropped out of treatment, if he otherwise failed to comply with the conditions imposed by the court, that the DA was going to bring him back in and recommend the 15 to 18 months in prison. In this case, the DA recommended to the judge 18 months in prison. The judge followed the recommendation, sent Chris to prison for 18 months with a period of parole, or we used to call it parole, now we call it post-prison supervision, set by the guidelines, 24 months. Now, that's what happens in our scenario. In reality, what will happen sometimes is that Chris comes before the court and the district attorney makes that recommendation. The defense attorney says, Judge, it's not quite as clear as all that. Yes, Chris threw a dirty UA. And yes, Chris dropped out of communications with his probation officer. But for 7 of the 8 months, he was doing great. And now in the last month, he has not done well. But he's back on track. He definitely wants to have another shot at this. I can just tell you as a judge, those are some of the hardest decisions I have to make. Because on the one hand, you've told Chris, if you don't take advantage of the upfront break, Chris, you're going to get the 15 to 18 months. And on the other hand, you have someone, the reality of the human being that's in front of you, who's done well for 7 months and now for 1 month has fallen off the off the wagon. And there's that tension between the desire to kind of make them experience what they were told from the beginning, the 18 months, and the belief that they maybe did just step off the track a little bit and they're back on. So those are real tensions that occur throughout our lives and throughout the lives of everybody in the system. It sounds easy to just go ahead and give the 18 months. Often we do. Sometimes I've actually said to a lot of offenders, you're going to serve time on the installment plan with me, and I will hold them for a while, release them a little bit, see how they do, make them report to me personally, put them back in if they're not doing well, and it's a juggling act, trying to keep them on track if I think they're doing fairly well, but they're slip-sliding a little bit. Other times, they're just thumbing their nose at the system. It's clear to me that they aren't ever going to engage, that it was all flash and talk when they were first in front of me, and then I just send them. So we're trying to prevent re-victimization with the tools that we have at our disposal. And I don't know, Judge McShane, if you have thoughts about that too, but it varies sometimes depending on the facts.
And I think it varies a little bit from judge to judge, but yeah. At the stage of the probation hearing, typically there's already been some administrative sanctions by the PO, and maybe some community service or 2 days in jail because of a dirty UA, so that there's been a lot of small failures by the time they come to see us. Often at that stage, it's really about kind of resource allocation. At some point, we have to start deciding, is it worth spending more time and money on resources for this individual when we have, of course, thousands of others waiting to get into treatment? Can this individual get into an inpatient program if that's the next step? And if they can't, that's kind of when we unfortunately kind of pull the plug and send that person to prison and start looking to fill the beds with someone else who might be more ready. But I spend a lot of time at that stage looking about and making a personal decision whether it's worth spending more local resources on this particular individual, the probation department, the drug treatment programs, all of that.
And I would say, as regards the local resources, for example, just using Multnomah County as an example, there were in the past many more local resources. We had a work release center. We had the Forest Project, which would take people up into the forest where they would clear trails. And some of the offenders had never been in the forest. They really had never been there. And they had NA and AA available up there. Other people we would put in the work release center, which was a supervised facility where they would go out during the day, learn job skills, get work, come back, they'd learn to budget, a brand new concept for many, many, many offenders, learning just to budget, learning to pay a bill. I had an offender one time say to me that he had paid his own rent one time, and you know, for the rest of us, that would be like, okay. But for him, it was this unbelievable achievement. And he wanted me to know of that. And so the Work Release Center would help people do that. But we've lost that funding because of restrictions in funding. And so we are now really left kind of with community service as one option and some drug treatment programs. But fewer structured programs, which we all, of course, as judges really like a lot, but the funding wasn't there. Now, are there any questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Maurer, do you know if the Restitution Center is been, the building that's been sold, or is it simply being mothballed and still owned by Multnomah County?
Don't know the answer to that. My perception is it's been sold, but I am not the person to know that for sure. Does someone know, Judge McShane?
It has been sold.
Yeah.
I believe it's
Again.
Yes.
It was the Michael Washington many years ago. The Ralph Meech, yes. I'm sorry.
Representative Newman first, then we'll get to Representative Dan.
Well, I guess maybe it's just me, and I'm not in the law enforcement circles per se, but this is very depressing to me to hear this because it's a bit like parenting, and it sounds like. And in parenting, You're offered the choice as a parent to back up your threats or whatever it is, or provide incentives and let your kids earn privileges to move to the next level of freedom or whatever. Is that ever considered to use treatment, since there's so few beds in treatment available, that to use that as a privilege to earn your way back out into the community, rather than just you're going to go there and you screw up and then you're left with the decision, did they screw up really bad, did they mean it? You know, it seems to me that you could use that as a privilege to be earned, and if the consequence of it, which doesn't seem to be an issue to a lot of the people, doesn't seem to matter because they often don't have to serve their consequence.
In answer to your question, yes, some jail sentences that we can impose are 6 months in jail with early release to treatment if the defendant qualifies and a bed becomes available. So yes, sometimes we impose that. My understanding at the DOC level, which is where we're going to move next, the Department of Corrections level, the prison system, is that they too have programs that the offender or the inmate can earn. And I don't know if anyone is here from DOC who wants to take a stab at that. Go ahead.
Nancy Sellers, Oregon Department of Corrections. We don't have release authority to let anyone out early unless they have qualified in open court as a sentencing judge for the alternative incarceration program. That's obviously not available to anyone who has a mandatory minimum sentence or other sentencing restrictions. If the judge has authorized that they're eligible for an AIP program, the inmate can apply, and then we will evaluate them to see if they meet the criteria for the treatment programs, and if they earn their way into the program, it's a six-month residential program followed by 90 days of transitional leave, and then they can receive a time cut to their sentences. Beyond that, alcohol and drug treatment programs are being prioritized to those with the greatest risk to reoffend. We have the high criminogenic alcohol and drug treatment need, but we don't have as many beds that certainly could be used by all of the inmates in our system.
And I would say your observation about parenting and the similarity between what we do and parenting is one that occurred to me. It took me much longer than it took you to figure that out, but one day I was talking to an offender and I thought, my word, this is really kind of what parenting is all about. And sometimes I do feel as though we have taken on that role. And on some cases I will set it up so that the offender, the probationer, comes to see me personally. I mean, we do it in open court. I don't have people just come in and chat with me in chambers, but I will have them in court. We'll have progress reports, see how they're doing. Sometimes that level of accountability seems to be of some assistance. I would like to do it with more, and I know when Judge McShane started on the bench, he had something that he called the Breakfast Club. Do you still have the Breakfast Club? Tell them about that. It's just an individual judge's effort to work with some of the people.
One of the things we found in the drug courts is that recidivism rates are a lot lower based on the fact that the probationers have a relationship with the judge. And I know it seems odd, but they don't have a lot of relationships in the system generally. The probation officers now are very busy. They don't see the same judge all the time. So they don't have that built-in relationship with a certain group of probationers. These tend to be juvenile measure 11 cases where we're trying probation before we send them to the penitentiary forever. They come see me every Friday morning. We have breakfast in the jury room, and we talk about what they're doing as far as school, as far as treatment. And so I have a very close relationship with them every day or every week, and what I find is they respond better. They come in trying to show me what they've accomplished that week. And what I also find is I know immediately if they're failing, so that we can do something very quickly, the probation officer, the principal of their school, because if they fail that program, they're going to prison for 70 months. So it's all or nothing on that program. There's a lot over their head. If they have a Measure 11 case that we're holding off sentencing them, and we've sentenced them on a more minor case, just to see how they're going to do in the community. So the sad part is, when they fail big from that program. But the idea is to give them a relationship with somebody, and they don't have the parent, they don't have the teachers that many of us have to help us through that process.
We had a couple of other questions. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you.
In this scenario, Chris, who's a father, stumbled. Maybe it was just one of those very temporary, short-lived things, but the father stumbled. We've been hearing about drug and alcohol treatment, but what opportunity or resources are there in the system to ascertain why Chris stumbled and to help? For example, was it pressure on a job, or did Chris just get laid off, or something in the home, something to do with family life with extra pressure on, or maybe the potential threat of loss of housing? What can we do to find out why Chris stumbled and to help prevent that from happening again?
Chairman Knudsen and all of the people who have that question, but in particular to answer your question, what I know I do, and I'm sure Judge McShane does as a judge, is to ask those very questions. The probation officer is there, typically with a report. The report will say that the probation officer received a termination notice from the drug treatment program, which outlined the efforts made by the drug treatment providers to get in contact with Chris, to talk to Chris about his need to re-engage. The probation officer's report will typically say, I tried to meet with Chris, I went out to Chris's residence, I left messages at Chris's house, Chris will not come in, Chris has not seen me. Or they will say, I did speak with Chris, Chris indicated that he would come and see me, we were going to get him back in treatment, and I haven't seen any sign of Chris. The last UA was dirty, Chris is beginning to look, and this is just what Judge McShane said, and we all know it when we see it, the slide has started. And you're right, the question is, why the slide? What happened? To the extent that the probation officers and the courts are able to kind of write the person again, resolve that issue, they sometimes fare well again in treatment. Other times, they just lose their bearings, and they're not in touch, they're committing new criminal activity, and that's why they're back in front of the court. Addiction, as I'm sure all of you know, is a tricky thing. It has a grip. You want to go ahead and answer or ask a question? Yes, you're the treatment
committee. My name is Karen Mayer, and the addiction is going to call for you. I would just say that addiction is extremely powerful. The reason people stumble, slip, and we call it relapse, addiction treatment, is not only because of the stressors. These people have friends that are calling them, people who try to get in contact with them. Their whole social system has been built on this network of people who use drugs typically. But they also have a brain disease. It's literally a brain disease. And there's something inside telling them every day to use, to use, to use. And I happen to know a lot of people in recovery who work at it day and night to stay in recovery. And they're very courageous people. So I would stress that it's a brain disease.
I asked the Department of Corrections specifically, I believe the representative was speaking about it. Our called criminogenic factors, and they've confronted areas like marital family, employment, education, alcohol and drug problems, those kinds of things. The vast majority of parole probation officers throughout the state use some form of criminogenic assessment. Varies from community to community, but those measure specifically those areas that she's speaking about, and they're generally done on a six-month interval. So an individual who gets into trouble like this, there will be some form of criminogenic assessment that will say these are the genesis of crime, these are the causal factors in criminality.
Without further comment, then we'll go to our next question.
Thank you. I would say we do expect in drug treatment, we expect relapse. The sad thing is the system with some individuals guarantees a relapse. We don't have any continuum of care from jail to the community into a living situation. Just to give a brief example, we take somebody who's mentally ill and a drug addict into jail. After 30 days, they lose their Social Security, have to reapply for it. They have a felony conviction, and they lose their public housing. We guarantee that individual is now released worse off because they're now homeless without funding by being in the system. just left them alone with their disability pay, with their housing. So sometimes we almost guarantee the relapse ourselves by the lack of that continuum of care.
Representative Morgan?
I come to this process through the perspective of budgeting. And in the last few sessions of the legislature, we've done a lot of work to put performance measures in place to try to gauge what's working and what isn't working, and then try to put some direction to fix what isn't working and put more money into what is working when we get that opportunity. And we have in place now for all of the human services programs and all of the public safety programs measures that we gauge the progress that the programs are making. And I'm wondering if you can comment from your perspective how those performance measures apply to you, or what you do with them, or how the information comes back to us and how real those kinds of things are for the kind of work that you have to do.
Okay, great.
Thank you. I'm Greg Hazard, Union Lane County Public Defender. One of the things I would say in answer to that, that also ties into Senator Burdick's question earlier, is to talk about drug court. Drug court is a set of programs around the state that has evidence-based practices written all over it. Drug courts are things that we know work better than the traditional solutions. And when the senator asked earlier about why didn't this client go to drug court, it's because the drug court resources are what they are. And as long as those resources are limited and there's only a certain amount of offenders who can get into drug court, then the district attorney, who's the gatekeeper, has to set up some criteria for who is going to get into drug court. And that limits how many people might benefit from it. I mean, I would simply tell you that I think finding ways to fund more slots for drug court, which would allow a wider range of offenders to get into drug court who would benefit from it. And when people in drug court succeed, the community wins as well. And that's maybe part of the answer.
And I know Judge McCain has something.
In Multnomah County, actually, we're, due to Judge Michael Marcus, we are literally the leading edge of performance-based sentencing in the nation. He speaks nationally on this topic. We have a program that's been developed over years, plugging in a number of variables about the offender and the crime, and it gives us literally a computer printout of what outcomes are most likely to affect recidivism. Unfortunately, a lot of those outcomes have disappeared. Work release was one of the big outcome measures, but we don't have that anymore. So we're losing our ability to look at what works because we're losing some of those resources. But we do have that resource. Most of the judges do use it when they're sentencing. We're trying to get the probation department very successfully using it when they make a recommendation for sentencing as well.
Yes, and I was going to say, because of Judge Marcus's efforts, now the probation officer's report, the pre-sentence reports that we received prior to sentencing, all factor in risk assessment and measures of the criminogenic factors that are in place and what sentence would most likely achieve the goals that everyone has. It's never one size fits all.
Mm-hmm.
It just isn't. People are complex creatures, and addiction is, of course, as she said, difficult.
Can I have a follow-up comment? I really appreciate your comments about drug court, and I have taken part in a number of instances in the drug court in Douglas County. And I think one of the things that helps that program be successful is the high level of communication between all of the compartments of social services and justice and the whole spectrum of services communicating together about that particular case. And I am also getting a feel from just the scenarios that you've unfolded yesterday and today that there does appear to be a high level of communication outside of drug court, but I'm wondering if there's potential to further those relationships and kind of use that drug court model in a wider application.
I would love to see that drug court model in a wider application. The reality is with someone like Mr. Lewis, they might not even be supervised by a probation officer in Multnomah County. They're put on what's called case bank. One probation officer, 700 to 1,000 cases. Those tend to be Class C felonies like what he has. So that communication piece, sometimes it's months before the judge hears what the probation officer knows, before the treatment provider gets the information. So that is a big piece in probation. Things have to happen quickly. And if there aren't consequences at the time, we really lose the ability to affect the offender.
And I want to say as well that in Multnomah County, and I don't know if it's true throughout the state, I think it is, the probation services has not been funded to supervise many misdemeanor probationers. So those are all on bench probation, which means that my judicial assistant now becomes the probation officer. So she is attempting to monitor, as is Judge McStain's judicial assistant and all of our judicial assistants, the conduct of each and every probationer. It is not technically her training or her job. She's very good at it now, but that is not what the role traditionally was for a judicial assistant. But it has become that role because we don't have the kinds of resources in place that allow probation services to do that. The continuum is key, in my opinion. And that's why, in the ideal world, you would have, I think, a relationship between the offender and the judge. Oftentimes, that is one of the most important components. It would be difficult to do it with the thousands of people who are on probation. But that is the that seems to be a very important component, consistency.
Judge Lee, I can just pause for a moment. I've got a couple more questions here, and I've apparently a comment. I just wanted to find out where we are in the flow of things. Are we interrupting the flow too much?
I love this part the most, and so it's hard for me, but I think we have until 10. Is that right?
That's right.
We have actually one other scene. Maybe we could do that, and then we'll take the questions. Does that work?
Can I just ask one question before we... it's of Judge McShane and your Breakfast Club. I was curious as to how you can get leverage over juvenile offenders vis-a-vis ballot measure 11. Is it you have these breakfast clubs before they're charged?
No, it's part of a sentence negotiations between me, the DA, and the defense attorney, and the defendant. For instance, a kid who stole a skateboard from another individual with adults, hit the kid with the skateboard. It also became a robbery, too. He's facing 70 months in prison. The adult offender went to prison for 70 months for that offense. This kid, he pled to a robbery 3 and the robbery 2. On the robbery 3, we placed him on probation. We settled for sentencing a year on that Measure 11 robbery 2 so that he knew if he failed that probation, he went back to drugs, dropped out of school, didn't get his GED. We had a whole list of conditions he had to follow, but then he would have to serve the 70-month prison sentence. He completed a drug treatment program. I went to his graduation. He did everything he was supposed to do up until the 11th month, where he committed a new crime on methamphetamines, went to prison for 70 months.
But say he had succeeded, would he...
Then we would have dismissed the Measure 11 offense. That was the agreement.
I just wanted to say on that before we keep going. This topic came up a little bit yesterday about sentence negotiations, plea negotiations. There are a number of judges who have become fairly active in that process. I am one of those judges, so is Judge McShane. I'm sure every county has a different system, based in part because I just have a high need to be involved in the lives of people that come before the courts. I frequently will set up something just like that. I don't call it the Breakfast Club, but it is a way of managing people's behavior while they remain in the community with the threat of something that might befall them if they're not serious. So because the prosecutors and because the defense bar have been open to more creative solutions, we're able to do this. So that's an answer to some of the questions yesterday about how negotiations can occur. With regard to the last scenario, Chris has now gone down to the Department of Corrections, and he is going to be meeting with the prison official. So Chris is now inside the intake center. Are we at Wilsonville? Is that where we want it to be? Wilsonville, the new facility there? That's the intake center for all offenders. All inmates, I should say.
Okay, good morning, Chris. I wanted to go over some things with you that you can expect while you're here at the Coffee Creek Intake Center and you'll be coming here with the Department of Corrections. First of all, we're going to assess, do an in-depth assessment of you, okay? We're going to look at your criminal risk factors. We're going to look at your health needs. We're going to look at your mental health needs. We're going to look at your education needs, your work experience, and then what custody limit you have. You're going to receive an individual correctional plan or incarceration plan. This is like more or less a guide that will navigate you through the system while you're with us within the department. And it will eventually take you out into the community where you'll be under supervision there. Once you complete this in-depth assessment and we complete the work plan, the corrections plan, we're going to transfer you to a prison that best suits your security level, your treatment needs, your program needs, and your work assignment. Okay? Chris, you're going to be required to work in a full-time work assignment. You're also going to be required to complete all required programs. While you're with us within the department, you may transfer from one prison to the next that meets the needs of your incarceration plan. Chris, did you know that children of inmates are more likely than their peers to be enrolled in the criminal justice system?
No, I didn't know that.
Well, it's a known fact. And so we're going to recommend that you request you put on a waiting list for the Department of Corrections Parenting Inside Out Program. Okay? This is going to help you be a better father and a better parent to your son. Okay? Now, Chris, about 6 months before you are scheduled to get out of the department, we're going to send you to a release facility. Okay? Here, you're going to work on a transition plan that will take you back into the community. Okay, Chris, now, all I've said, it's going to be your choice to be productive with your time while you're with the Department of Corrections, and I really hope that you choose to be so.
Thank you.
All right, now, Chris, as it turns out, took that to heart, and he was a model prisoner, so he received some time off of his sentence, 3 months of good time. He's now being released to transitional housing. His conditions of release during the 24 months of post-prison supervision, which we used to call parole, are that he not drink alcohol, that he not use drugs, that he participate in mental health treatment, and that he not commit any new crimes. So here he is now with the transitional housing sponsor.
Thank you, Chris. I'm the director of sponsors. This is a transitional housing program for the released offenders. Now, you're going to have to follow our house rules in order to live here. And we're going to help with your transition back to society and with getting you a new job. We're also going to help you get to all your treatment appointments.
Hi again, Chris. Hello. You're looking healthy today.
Yeah, you got that jar.
We're here to help you in your recovery. We already did an assessment, so we're going to update that a little bit and get you back in the program. We're really excited to see you again. And we'll want to work with your family as well and do some family counseling.
Good.
Hope that's good for you.
Good. I'll do better this time.
And we'll want you to go to AA and NA meetings. And again, we'll be working really closely with your parole officer on this.
I'll be doing that in prison.
Okay. We'll be taking new ways as well. Hopefully you can pay some for your treatment. We'll have a sliding fee scale.
All right. So, Chris now is out, and he's hopefully engaged in his treatment. And it goes one of two ways. It either is a situation where Chris gets back on track, he has a job, he's drug and alcohol free, he's back with his family, he's reunited with his children, or, of course, there's always plan B. Plan B is that he does that for a while, but then he begins to associate with his former friends, he stops going to his treatment plan, he is using again, and he commits a new car theft, and he is back in the system. And at that time, his probation, or rather his post-prison supervision, is going to be considered in violation, and there will be a hearing, and he will go into a local jail where he will spend a sanctioned period of time. Then he'll come back out on post-prison supervision, and they will start over again with him. That is essentially the, I would say, the Department of Corrections side of what the court side with probation services was before. First we tried the probation side, that didn't work, he went to prison. Now he's come out of prison and he's on that 2-year period of post-prison supervision, and that may result in success or failure, it just depends on Chris. So, any other thoughts that anybody here wants to express? Yes, go ahead, and then maybe there's some questions.
Chris Hansen with the Public Defender's Office in Eugene. I am that Chris. Over the last 30 years, I've been a public defender, addressing the comment that your judge made and one of your issues, and I regret I can't remember your name, I can't see it, but there you are. I've seen the rise of methamphetamine use and the fall of resources available to deal with it. The judge talked about the caseloads in Multnomah County. I personally called a probation officer up there who told me on his voicemail that he had 600 clients and probably wasn't going to be calling me back. And I've watched in Lane County the elimination, the gradual evisceration of probation officers, the numbers available, and the experience available. Those with 10, 15, 20 years are leaving. They're not being treated right. They're not being paid. They're not being given the resources that allow them to come out and handle my clients. Now, I'm not the prosecutor's pal here, but I'll tell you, my clients, I got all the business I can use. I do not need, I don't really want to have all these guys come back. They're taking my TV too. And if the state wants sausage to be earthy about it, so that they for the cases. The Department of Corrections and all of these resources, the drug treatment programs, got to be less expensive than incarcerating somebody in the inner county. They've got to be less expensive. And possibly more effective, because as somebody said in the beginning, all of these people get out, but they all come home. Your name?
Chairman Pearson, I know you said some other people had.
We had a couple of questions in queue. Representative Shields? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Maurer, you had mentioned pre-sentencing investigations. Could you comment on how that's changed over the years, how often they happen now compared to how often they happened before?
When I started in practice many years ago, they were common. Every case pretty much had a pre-sentence report once that system was in place. Thereafter, it was curtailed dramatically because with the mandatory minimum sentencing schemes in place, which cover all Measure 11 offenses, and the repeat property offender sentencing, which is in place, although it is not mandatory, 13 months on a qualifying offense, is typical. We haven't had to have as many pre-sentence reports on those cases because the sentencing scheme is in place, and it doesn't matter what information the judge has. The judge must impose that mandatory minimum sentence. In the other cases that are still within our discretion, I find that I rely with some degree of consistency on the pre-sentence report writing process. And I don't know, I wish I did know, I don't know if you know, Michael, how many PSI writers we have right now in Multnomah County. I'm not sure.
Two.
Two, is that it? I thought it had gone up a little while. Still two? So we have limited resources in that regard. I like having PSI writers because they give me kind of a background that I don't necessarily get from other sources.
So, thank you, Judge Maurer. So then if what I hear is correct, that a lot of the discretion in the system has moved from judges towards the charging in the prosecutor's office. So not only do those pre-sentencing investigations not exist at your desk, but the DAs aren't getting anything like that as well, except looking at criminal history. Is that correct?
Correct. And let me explain in just a nutshell the difference between sentencing guidelines and mandatory minimum sentencing. sentencing guidelines are precisely that. They are guidelines. So we have a score that is assigned to every criminal offense, and we have a letter score that is assigned to every offender. And we therefore have a, what we call a gridlock. You just look over if you're a level 6 and you're a level D, you go over to the gridlock and it tells you what the range of the sentencing is. Those are not, however, mandatory. They are presumptive sentences. They are sentences the judges are supposed to impose, that if the judge finds mitigating factors can go down and under some circumstances can depart upward. In those kinds of cases, the pre-sentence report can be very helpful. It's just that the lawyers have oftentimes talked to one another, negotiated for a sentence. They come before the court. We ask, what is the reason for this negotiation? It seems reasonable to us, and we impose it, and we don't need the PSI. Where I find the PSI is the most helpful is in those areas where we have discretion. The DA, too, wants to know what the pre-sentence report writer will find. And so the defendant enters a plea, and there will be an agreement that at no event would the defendant have a sentence in excess of, and then a number will be picked. But a pre-sentence report will come in, we'll take a look at that, and maybe there are reasons to go downward from that. So the DA sometimes has the information from the pre-sentence writer prior to making the sentence recommendation. But in Measure 11 offenses, of course, the if the parties haven't negotiated off of Measure 11, then, of course, it's just mandatory.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to the comment that Judge McShane had made regarding, and please excuse me if I paraphrase, but we set up our offenders to fail. Going back to when Chris was out, he met with his probation officer and then his transition person and so on. We've terminated all of their sustenance, their income, because for whatever reason they're on a system that the state or the federal provide benefits. So we are sending them out now without a driver's license, without resources, to the community, from a very controlled community and to a community at large. And with all of those factors in play, they're highly negative. Resource discussion aside, is that more of a system failure?
Well, I think it is a system failure, and that the best we can do with somebody like Chris when he's just released is to release him often back to the streets, back to the same environment. We're not changing anything about the environment. I think most people in addiction counseling will agree, if you don't change that environment of who they're with, who they go to for support, homelessness being a big issue too, we're not really changing anything. We don't have, it really is, we don't have a work release center to send them to when we know that's an issue, or send them to the forest camp so that they can be working and then working on a new environment when they get out. That continuum, without that continuum, we are really just setting a lot of people up to go right back to where they were when they started, but expecting them to change, and it just doesn't happen.
And if I could just add to that, I find that that is, of course, absolutely true, and in fact, not to make this all about me, but I oftentimes tell offenders that, although I don't suffer from an addictive personality, which I don't, that I have some understanding of it because I have on countless occasions told myself that I will adhere to whatever resolution I've made in my life. It doesn't matter what it is. In my case, it's typically not eating ice cream. It's something I cannot stay away from. The food of the gods, you have to have it every day, apparently. And I tell the offenders that. They actually all know that I'm addicted to, if you want to use it that way, to ice cream. And I tell them that with all of my education and a family that supports me and everything going my way, I still open that freezer and pull out that ice cream. And so I understand why it is that people fail. But I also have an abiding belief in human beings. And for all of the failures we see, we do have successes. We do. It's hard to know precisely what turned it for that offender. But I have had successes, and people come back, and maybe it was after a prison stint. Maybe it was because they got in with a new group. Maybe they just found a support system. And they do change. And I'm sure you've seen that as well, where even though the continuum we struggle for, they just sometimes manage. But I think the continuum is the key.
Thank you. On the slide that you had up that showed the number of intakes to prison, there seemed to be a very modest decrease from 04 to 05, and then the first 6 months of 06. Do you project that there will be another modest decline, and to what do you attribute the modest decline?
Co-chairs and members of the Nancy Salazar Department of Corrections. Those things do fluctuate a little bit. The prison population forecast is projected to continue to rise. The angle of that growth is not as steep as was originally projected by the Office of Economic Analysis at the Department of Administrative Services, but it is still going up. So you can expect intakes to increase. There just are some natural fluctuations. Length of sentence. It is what's growing the inmate population more than new intakes, because this measure level of mandatory minimum sentences increase the length of those sentences, and the beds turn over less frequently. It doesn't take as many intakes to still grow the population. And I can give you more specific information on the numbers of intakes, and perhaps if you like, but it really depends on sentencing practices in counties within the year of the correction that will end up the goal.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to what you were talking about, Judge Mauer, about the elimination of programs like the Forest Camp and similar programs. And do I correctly assume that elimination of those programs happens statewide and not just in Multnomah County?
I don't know what each county does. Those were county programs, and decisions were made when the county lacked funding and they had to make certain decisions, and those were the decisions they made.
Okay, and follow-up, Mr. Chair?
No.
And I wonder if someone or some entity is keeping records or statistics or studying rates of recidivism along with the elimination of programs like that, because it seems like an investment that may be well spent if it's actually keeping people from getting back into the system.
We do have statistics available. Judge Marcus is a person who keeps such numbers, and I'm sure he would be thrilled to come and talk with all of you.
Thank you very much.
Are there any further questions? Well, Judge Mauer, do you have any closing comments about the conclusion of this presentation?
I think what I would just hope that we were able to convey in a relatively simplistic fact scenario was the degree to which decisions you all make have an impact on the total environment. In other words, as I started out, I told you that this is about the interconnectedness of all of the parts of the system. And sometimes, for example, a decision, just to use as an example, to curtail crime might be to add 100 new police officers. I think no one could quarrel with the effectiveness of law enforcement. But if you don't have a similar increase in services or individuals along the spectrum, that won't achieve the overall global goal of meeting the needs of all of the people in the system. And so it's kind of like an ecosystem, honestly. If you push here, it gets affected there. All of us, frankly, are working very hard, as you can see, to deal with very complicated issues. My final comment would be just that we would love to have contact. I don't know if you want contact, but we would like contact. We would love to talk to all of you. So, and I don't know if anyone else has any comments they would like to make. It's really also been such a privilege to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I want to thank you, Judge Maurer, for coming, and then thank all the actors who participated in this drama. It really kind of brings it to life, which is something that we need to have. Some might say a somewhat sterile environment sometimes when we sit in here and we look at flow charts and bullet points, and to have it kind of presented on a human scale, I think, is very helpful to us. And it was particularly striking to me about it's a system, it's a really human system. It's full of human quirks and idiosyncrasies and frailties, and it's not mechanical. It's something where we have to set up a certain machinery of justice, but we also have to make sure that machinery is engaging all those human weaknesses in the most effective way. So thank you again for your work on this. I'll turn then the program back over to Doug Wilson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committees, real briefly, since it's a couple minutes after 10, there's a packet of material at your desk here that we put on. This is a reference document. Again, one of the things that we as staff wanted to make sure you understand, as the actors, are the interconnectivity of all these programs. Judge Maurer mentioned that at the end, mentioned the law enforcement increases, but the downstream impact on services. Also want to address you to the back of that document. Again, I won't go through it because of the time. On the last two or three pages, the key issues, again, that are public safety issues, or some of the key issues, and of course we didn't pick them up, name the funding, pointing out again what you learned in the past couple of days around the importance of access to drug and mental health services, some of the underfunding because of high caseloads that staff, probation officers, DAs, compensation for Public Defense Service Commission, contractors and indigent defense. All those are big issues that will need to be addressed here in this session, or at least mentioned and decisions made on. So hopefully you'll take that into account, and hopefully you've sort of gotten an idea today, an overview of in the past couple of days of the system and how it works.
Senator Carter.
If I may, I think if we as the Human Services Committee and you as the Judiciary Committee miss the point of 700-to-1 ratio, we will miss the point of what recidivism is all about. And unless we can help probation officers to have lesser numbers that is much more manageable, we're going to still be paying the highest cost on the corrections end of things if we don't do something about that ratio. And I'm hoping that of all the things that have been said today, that we as a body get that piece.
Mm-hmm. Okay, if there are no further comments from the committee, then we are adjourned.